The I have to say though, the Hotz-Musk relationship is just fascinating to me.
It really is. You can't think of two people more perfectly suited to troll the other one. Like they're kind of a match made in heaven.
Yeah. It's sort of like one of those, relationships where, you know, people are either like desperately in love or just like throwing things at each other, and there's like zero middle ground.
Oh God. Now all I can think of is Elon writing Elon Hotz out over and over again.
Hey, who among us?
Hey, this is Damon Lavritz. This is the Atonicast, and I am joined, as always, by Mr. Roy and Mr. Niedermeyer. How are you guys doing?
Great to be here.
Yep, doing well.
More enthusiasm. More energy.
So much enthusiasm. We've been gone for a week and a half. I'm not even going to ask what Ed was doing with his time. I'm assuming just a lot of skiing. but yeah, since we've been gone, some pretty sizable stuff has happened, particularly with Uber. So, you know, I want to kind of jump into this from a couple different angles. And, you know, I'm sure everybody is kind of up on what's been going on recently. So we've got just the terrible culture within Uber that's been prolific for years and hasn't really shown any signs of stopping. We had then, of course, the blog post that came out by a female engineer who had a really, really awful experience there, which is indicative of pretty much every female experience I've heard at Uber, and for that matter, any automotive and tech companies out here, tech companies overall, but automotive tech in particular. And it just kept on getting worse, right? We had Travis yelling at a driver, which I didn't think it was that bad.
But I agree.
It's just further proof that he's just a douche.
Wait, stop right there. It's further proof that the biggest elephant in the room is your privacy when in a car with cameras running.
Yeah, that's a good point.
There was some question about whether or not that was actually legal in California, because this was recorded in San Francisco, if I recall. And of course, we have very, very strict
privacy protections.
Isn't there something in terms of service that about the driver being allowed to keep a camera rolling for his own safety?
I don't know. I mean, it could be in Uber's TOS. I'm not sure. But it's also private property too. So there's the legal issues, whatever. But more importantly, then there's Waymo coming out of the gate and really coming out with some serious charges against former engineers that left Google's self-driving car program, went to their own startup called Otto, was bought by Uber, and apparently they're ripping off the LiDAR, allegedly.
Have you seen the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yes.
All right, have you seen it, Ed?
Yes, I have.
I'm going to quote from that movie, because you know that every single day, Travis gets to the office, and the comms guy shows up, and the lawyer shows up, and he says, "Damn, we in a tight spot." Please continue, Damon.
Jesus. Well, I guess the latest is Grayball, which is their program to basically skirt authorities, right? So they have it set up so they used a combination of like geo alerts about like, you know, buildings where municipal workers are at. If somebody picks up a ride from there and also like uses a credit card from a police credit union, a car would miraculously arrive and disappear. And they were doing all of this to avoid detection, particularly in your hometown, Ed, Portland.
Yep. They've had numerous issues here getting approval, so that's not at all surprising.
Seriously, whoever designed the Grayball stuff for Uber should quit and go work for InQtel or Palantir or like the government, because that's clearly didn't work well enough to protect Uber, but it's also many steps down the right path for intelligence services. I mean, that's
well, it worked well enough to protect Uber for the last year and a half until some people talked about it. So, yeah, I mean, but let's put this really into perspective, though. We had pretty much at least one bad story a week for the last 3 weeks from Uber. But let's make sure this is really, really clear. Uber's problems have been around for much, much longer than that. You know, what, 6, 7 years they've been doing this. And it seems as though that this Randian philosophy is finally coming back to bite them in the ass. So, yeah, I mean, being out here and just seeing kind of the awfulness that is the culture with a lot of these startups, like, this wasn't surprising. I think what is surprising is that it took 2 or 3 people coming out, and one of them actually using their name, which I think is really
damn it.
Brave. What's that? Well, it gives that much more credence to the allegations, right? Like, when you're using your name, there's so much more there to it. But again, this isn't something that's specifically at Uber. It's throughout the valley, but it seems to be typified in its purest form with Uber.
I mean, the leather jacket story was really incredible. I mean, just for anyone who doesn't know the story, a certain team, you know, the company was going to provide leather jackets for the members of the team. I think it was 100 and some odd people, and the majority were men, and they all agreed on a style of jacket, and the cost per jacket, I think, was like $100 and change, you know, cost. But the 6 or 7 women who were going to get jackets, the cost was like 180 or something. Who knows? It was more. And whoever was in charge of getting the jackets told the women that they couldn't have the jackets because it was more expensive. And the company would only pay if they could source jackets at the same price, because if the women's jackets cost more than the men's jackets, it was discriminatory, which is insane. Like, if this happened in a post office, that someone would have bought a gun and come back to the office, killed everyone. And if you think, imagine being like in seventh grade and that happening, like, you know, you'd have a nervous breakdown. And here, adults are being asked to submit to this insane, twisted logic, which is completely, forget discrimination, it's humiliating and it's insulting. And especially for that woman who was the project leader who wrote that article, and it's just unbelievable, especially for a company with, you know, with the kind of money that they have.
This is a company, by the way, that is valued more than a lot of major automakers. I mean, it's over $60 billion valuation right now. So,
and I should also add, I'm in the my hobby business is I'm in the clothing business, and the difference between a $100 jacket and a $110 jacket, I mean, it's a difference of like $200 for Uber. It's insanity. It's just insanity.
It's interesting to me to see the reaction to this, because I mean, these are all really important stories, and obviously there's a thread that ties them all together, which is the company's culture. One of the things that I'm curious to see more about is sort of quantifying the cost of this PR debacle, because I mean, clearly this is probably the worst sort of rolling PR nightmare that's happened in Silicon Valley since, well, I guess Theranos wasn't that long ago. But it's a big one. What's interesting though is that when Kalanick was on Trump's advisory panel, and that's when this Delete Uber campaign sort of started, and based on the volume of news coming out of here, I have to think that these two are related. But what's interesting to me is that before he stepped down from that panel under pressure, I saw it reported that something like 20,000 people deleted their Uber accounts as part of this Delete.
200,000.
Was it 200,000? Okay. A lot of people, right? What I'm wondering is, you know, is this causing more people to delete their accounts? Fewer? Like, I want to know the relationship. Like, what, in terms of impacting their bottom line, right? Because you look at what's in the media and, you know, some things are worse than others and you can make subjective decisions about that. But at the end of the day, right, this stuff gets down to, the impact of this gets down to, it's quantifiable, right? How many people delete their accounts? I'm really curious. You know, are more people deleting their accounts now in response to these kinds of stories than they were after the Trump thing, or what? Like, what's the relationship there? Because to me, it's just really interesting that, you know, stories about how Uber can't make, you know, money on their rides, you know, how much money they're losing, how they're kind of going backwards in terms of their move towards profitability and these various metrics. You know, those stories don't really seem to move the needle too much. Although, to be fair, this is a private company, so you don't have sort of stock prices, right? So you can't track that stuff in real time. And they haven't had a funding round since. But I'm just wondering, you know, is this going to have a quantifiable impact on their business the way the Trump advisory panel thing did?
Well, you know, there was, you know, Ryan Felton at Jalopnik wrote this great article last week about Uber's doomed. And he, as his starting point, used, I think, a 4 or 5 part series on Zero Hedge about how Uber, who from day one, almost certainly bet everything on achieving a monopoly in one or more major markets. And that without that, they are doomed, and that they're already past the point of no return, that there's no way for them to get to monopoly anywhere. And so how self-driving cars can't save them. And in all this, whatever their original plan was, it's incredible. I mean, do they not have competent communications people at the company? Is there no one advising Kalanick or anyone else about how to manage growth without making these mistakes? I mean, Kalanick was in that car. How could he not have known when he was in the car with that driver, the camera is running, and if he behaves like that, it's not going to get quoted.
Alex, you're thinking of this from a normal, functional human being's perspective. And it's just a totally different world, because all of that stuff seems not just acceptable, but is encouraged.
Yeah, you know, it seems like, you know, looking at Silicon Valley, I guess it's not endemic to self-driving startups, but self-driving startups just happen to be getting so much more press in the last, you know, 2 years than anyone else. But Uber, I guess auto is part of the same operation. There just have to be the worst run in terms of public relations communications of any major startup ever. Theranos at least put up a fight up until, you know, getting caught. But these guys just get it wrong every single time. They should fire everybody in the communications department. I mean, everybody.
But this isn't an issue with the communications department, man. Like, I know people in the comms department, and there are a lot of really, really smart people over there. This is the top down, man. This and yeah, there are people that are on the comms team that subscribe to the Travis way of thinking. But at the end of the day, like, these people are just doing the same kind of marching orders. It's like blaming Tesla comms people. It's like, this has nothing to do with the people that are working communications at Tesla. It has everything to do with Elon Musk.
I would say Tesla comms people are a lot more competent than, than the folks at Uber. You know, which begs another question. You know, Kalanick says that self-driving cars are an existential issue for them. But there's no evidence that self-driving cars will save them at all, because, yeah, you know, let's say they had autonomy tomorrow and they saved, they theoretically saved 70% off the driver's cost. If you are never been in a self-driving car, trust is everything. So why would you get into the self-driving car of a company you already loathe with technology you've never checked out before, unless it was cheaper than using a human driver? So Uber will never see the 70% savings, even if autonomy does arrive. They're going to have to discount that like crazy. And then they're up against everyone else who's discounting it. And they're doomed, man. Like, Uber is there. I can't see a path out for these people.
Yeah, I think there's two big issues that they've set themselves up really poorly to deal with in the future. One of them, obviously, is just regulators, right? I think there's a growing understanding, appreciation of the fact that, you know, autonomy is not just a technical issue, a technological issue. It's very much a regulatory issue. And they've proven, an attitude and a sort of set of cultural values through all of these stories. But then you also have, you know, in California and in Nevada with auto, this record of really just bad relationship. Really, it's not even a bad relationship. They're not even trying to have a relationship with regulators. And really, the regulators are not being onerous in any of these states. They're just some basic reporting requirements. And Uber has flaunted them all. So I think, you know, going forward, right, there's a public trust issue, but there's also a trust with regulatory issue. And the two are intertwined. And, you know, I think regulators always have too much on their plate. And they have to make hard choices about sort of what to focus on. And it seems to me that the kind of stories that are coming out of Uber, both in terms of their relationships with state-level regulators, but also just, again, these stories that illustrate a broader culture issue, that really sets them up to be the target for regulators, right? Because, you know, those regulators have to prioritize. And clearly, this is a company that seems to be a target-rich environment for a regulator. The other issue, which you sort of hint at, but I think it's slightly different than what you're talking about, Alex, is, you know, there's always been this challenge of how does Uber transition from being a marketplace in which it connects consumers with drivers and both of whom are sort of partner groups that Uber has to have some kind of trust and, you know, trusting relationship with, you know, as long as the sort of eventual triumph of self-driving cars, autonomous vehicles, is on the horizon, right, that's always going to have put pressure on their relationship with their drivers. Obviously, as from the video and other things, we can tell that relationship is not great anyway. But getting, you know, if it was like a fairy waving a magic wand and you know, Uber would have autonomous technology overnight, you know, that transition would be painful but brief, right? It would just be, sorry, we're not paying you drivers anymore, go away. As it is, though, you know, it's obvious that there's going to be a transition towards autonomy, and that transition could take a long time. A, it's dependent on regulators where there's not a lot of trust, but B, I think as that transition starts to become more real, as drivers start to realize that, yes, you know, these robots are coming for our jobs sooner rather than later, the potential for a PR nightmare there is very real. And I think what Uber is sort of demonstrating with all these stories is, you know, they're not going to handle that gracefully. It's going to be ugly. And, you know, if this current PR crisis weren't happening for Uber now, it seems like A, the culture would have created some kind of crisis down the road. But ultimately, we know that this massive transition from sort of this huge population of people who were your business partners and which you are simply going to discard, that PR problem now, I think, is even more potentially disruptive to the company or dangerous to the company because they have set themselves up in the eyes of the public and of their drivers as being so disrespectful and egotistical and as Damon said, douchey.
Yeah, that sums it up. I got to agree with that for a change.
But getting back to just kind of the cultural issues and how they relate to some of these news stories. So yeah, I think the lawsuit from Waymo is kind of like the latest indication of that, right? So Waymo is suing Otto, or Uber by extension through Otto, because Anthony, is it Levendowski? Mm-hmm. Who worked on the self-driving car program really early on, and I think I met him years ago. But he had apparently, according to Google, allegedly downloaded something like, what was it, like 14,000 documents, and it was almost like 10 gigs of confidential files. And the way Waymo, this was brought to Waymo's attention, was one of their suppliers had apparently sent over a design for a LiDAR system that was actually going to be used by Otto, and the technology, the LiDAR array that they developed, looked remarkably similar to Google's technology.
If I may answer for one second, you know who's doing killer reporting on this is Mark Harris. And he did an article a couple of days ago citing that he thinks that one of his stories may have been the one that tipped off Waymo to this. And in an incredible kind of side note, like to this, one of his stories, which I've not seen more broadly covered, is that I think in Arizona, Uber applied and got permission to operate an autonomy certification site in state, basically putting them in charge of certification for anyone applying for permits there, which is all insanity, utter insanity.
Hey man, it's you know, this is the public-private partnerships that all of our conservative friends talk so much about.
Well, and this is clearly an example of a company with a deep knowledge of and respect for the entire regulatory system and process. So clearly, who better to put in charge of this stuff?
I mean, it's like Theranos. It's like Theranos being in charge of certifying blood testing methods, like, you know, in California. Like, that would be fucking bonkers.
So this lawsuit is actually, I think it's really interesting, A, because of what it illustrates about Uber, which we're sort of getting the picture on. But also, I think when you look at it next to Tesla's lawsuit against Sterling Anderson, their former head of Autopilot, who they allege has essentially done a very similar thing than what Google is alleging.
The lawsuit, the Tesla lawsuit, it wasn't hardware, though. It was software.
It was
right?
Software. That is a key distinction. But it was essentially downloading, you know, documents.
Right.
And technical data.
It was still, you know, essentially claiming that he stole IP.
Yep.
Right.
So to me, right, there's this question of what is causing this, right? Is this a question of, you know, this is, you know, Sterling Anderson and Lewandowski, you know, are these just bad apples, sort of, you know, people with not a lot of right moral fiber? That's one possible explanation. The other interesting explanation that was floated, I think, in a Bloomberg piece a week or two ago was sort of within the case of Google that, you know, maybe something in their compensation structure, you know, there was so much money being given out that it sort of created this incentive for people to try and take that and use it as seed capital to do their own startup. That's an interesting explanation that maybe it's a cultural problem specific to Google. And who knows? I mean, in the case of Tesla, there certainly could be cultural factors at that company that might have contributed to the circumstances we're seeing there. But I think the broader, you know, explanation, and this is the one I think that interests me the most, is that, you know, is there sort of a culture around Silicon Valley more generally that is sort of eroding, you know, respect for rules and for fair play? And I think when you look at these two lawsuits, and then you look at sort of how some of these companies operate more broadly with respect to regulators and whatnot, it almost gives you the impression, and there's quite a few data points stacking up on this now, that like Silicon Valley is maybe having kind of a moral crisis. Like maybe they sort of lost touch with values that cannot be quantified in stock option compensation plans, and that the sense of right and wrong is gone. And like this is not just one person, a couple people, or a couple companies, but this may be a broad issue. I don't want to tar, you know, this entire sector with one brush, but I'm curious.
There's clearly something endemically wrong here, right? Like there is something there, and I'm not sure if it's, you know, just the general sense of entitlement out here, but I think you bring up a really good point, Ed, which is this kind of erosion of norms, right? There's some connection there. There is something about people just saying, why do we have these norms to begin with if they're not benefiting me?
Well, just to back up for a second, when you cited, Ed, this Bloomberg article about how high the compensation levels were for people in the self-driving project. I'm not convinced that they were so high that people were leaving and using the money as seed capital. I think the Bloomberg piece conclusion was that people were being paid so much, they were just getting out and because they don't need to use the money, cashing out of their options to start up self-driving companies. There's probably an unlimited supply of money flowing into any startup with self-driving tech. I'm also not convinced that there's an erosion of norms. I think what's happened is everybody in Silicon Valley who had saw an opportunity to cash out at any point going back 30 years, they'll cash out when they want to cash out. I think what's happened is that the mythology of Silicon Valley being a place of superior morality or common good, it's that mythology which is cracking to reveal the reality of people just doing business. And when you have the sums of money involved that you have, sooner or later, the mythology cannot support itself. And
that's
Especially with things like Lewandowski, you know, trying to copy files and designs and pull them. How Lewandowski and how anyone in the current day and age can believe that a company-owned laptop, that you could do anything on that without being monitored, indicates something else, which is that
at Google, of all places, for crying out loud, we're going to organize the world's information, and you think we're going to keep that technology off your laptop?
So the reality is that people at the highest levels of executive management at companies that are expected to know better are as ignorant of privacy and surveillance as the average person. that's the revelation for me.
Yeah, no, and the question is it an issue of ignorance? Or is it a culture of impunity? And
both.
Yeah. And again, you can look at, I think the most interesting thing for me about all this is that you look at individuals and you look at companies and you see that same sense of the rules don't apply to us.
Right.
And again, you know, it's easy to, I think, given all these stories, sort of knock Silicon Valley. And to be clear, I think, you know, pushing regular, you know, allowing technology to push regulations, not simply holding back, you know, that has been something that has been very positive for Silicon Valley itself, for our economy more broadly and all that. But I think, you know, this is part of this broader issue of getting into cars. And when you start getting into cars, all of a sudden the stakes are much higher. It's people's lives, not just, you know, how fast can your photo load or whatever, you know, some of these other, you know, apps and software and communications type of stuff where you don't have that life or death thing. And I think it's very interesting that, you know, there also seems to be a bit of a sense that, you know, broadly in the federal regulatory regulation of automotive safety, that maybe some companies have been given a bit of a free pass for a while now, and that maybe that might be changing. We had Elaine Chao sort of vaguely intimate this, and I've heard from other people that this is definitely something that is on the radar. And you know, frankly, I think, you know, obviously, you know, the new administration has, you know, lots of baggage, shall we say, that, you know, some people like and some people don't. There's all this. But I think if you look at this culture in Silicon Valley that is clearly one of impunity and disrespect for basic, you know, compliance with rules and regulations and norms, I think the argument that, you know, the regulators on a federal level have sort of set a tone in which there is, you know, that fosters this sense of impunity, I think it's becoming a compelling argument. I think all of this news really kind of supports that. And now the question that I, you know, I'm faced with, you know, thinking about that is, I think that's a good thing, right? I think that you know, if you have a culture of impunity, you've got to do something to sort of reestablish, you know, both regulations and norms. Right. But the question is, you know, how do you do that without squashing the innovation that is happening? And I think that's a really challenging task that the new Department of Transportation is going to really have their hands full dealing with.
Well, you know, but there's also a tremendous opportunity for someone like Lyft or someone else to come in and, you know, preempt these problems or preempt, you know, the perception that such a culture of impunity exists. And attack, like from a marketing standpoint, issues of privacy and access and sexism up front and brand themselves as the company that is not like that, and really aggressively and turn these problems into you know, positives for anyone who's not Uber.
Well, no, actually, since you mentioned Lyft, it's just a question that I've been mulling over in the back of my mind. I'd love to get your guys' take on it. You know, Lyft is worth somewhere around very approximately 10% of what Uber is. You know, obviously I think Uber, probably most people could agree, it's overvalued to some extent. Is Lyft undervalued? And to me, you know, you look at that spread, it's just massive. And it looks to me like Uber is insanely overvalued, and that, you know, in part because of this PR, but in part because of just the economics of it, that valuation will have to be corrected, which, as we all know, Silicon Valley firms that are in the private stages do not take to those kinds of corrections very well. I'm wondering, do you think that this whole Uber drama is going to result in a down round? Is it going to result in sort of a major, like, existential financial crisis for the company? Or is this going to, you know, a year from now kind of look like a speed bump?
It's certainly a possibility, but, you know, there's a lot of people that are far smarter than me that have maintained for a long time there's not a lot of there. Really quickly, getting back to the cultural thing, you know, we were talking, I was bringing up norms earlier, and one of the things that kind of occurred to me is the fact that there are some companies out here that have actually taken advantage of these changing norms to make a more healthy, like, company culture. Like, I understand Lyft is actually supposed to be a pretty nice place to work. I'm meeting more people from Airbnb, and there are companies out here that have done a really, like, have taken their time in an effort to really kind of make a culture that they think works best for what they're doing. To get back to the point Ed brought up about Lyft, first of all, I'm sure you guys have seen the reports. Like, they're actively pursuing their next round right now. And I guess the larger question is, I'm trying to figure out if that's the smart thing to do or if now's the time for them to just lay low.
I mean, when your number one competitor is suffering like this, it can't be bad. And frankly, looking at the macro situation, it's hard to imagine over the course of this year or next year that it's really going to get much better. In fact, my guess would be the broader sort of macroeconomic situation may not be, you know, may actually be worse. 12 months from now. Mm-hmm. So to me, that seems like a smart idea. Of course, it depends on what they're doing with the money, which I'm not as familiar enough with Lyft to know right offhand.
Well, I actually think Lyft is undervalued. And if they raise any money, I think they should spend every cent branding themselves as the anti-Uber, and everything Uber's doing wrong, they should, market around that. You know, there's interesting things from last week. A couple weeks ago, GM unit Cadillac launched their book project, and then Maven announced a thing called, wait a sec, Maven Reserve.
Actually.
So Maven Reserve, is another interesting step in tying together concepts of mobility. So if you take Cadillac book and Maven Reserve, GM is now in the lead for, attacking the notion of cars as subscription. And so, they're making real progress towards a day when they can bind together Maven Reserve, Cadillac book, and Lyft in some kind of unified mobility pyramid. And so that's a huge advantage over Uber, who are basically going it alone. And Uber has, multiple partnerships with all kinds of people, including GM. But,
but they're not making hardware. They're not making cars.
And, I've been super, bullish on Silicon Valley, semi-autonomous technologies. But this is a situation where you actually have a manufacturer doing more than just paying lip service. BMW's reach now, for me, is just an unserious initiative compared to the very bold steps GM has taken. So I'm getting actually really, really bullish on Lyft's long-term prospects. I mean, if Uber ends up being the Cosmo of ride hailing, 15 years after Cosmo collapsed, we do have delivery services. Not as comprehensive, unified, and global as Cosmo's had hoped to be, but there's a lot more behind Lyft than there is behind Uber.
I've maintained Lyft's been right-sized, both kind of scale-wise and valuation for a while. I still think almost everything out here is overvalued, but in the larger scale.
I keep Uber on my phone because I feel like I need to be aware of its functionality over time. But if you look at, look more broadly, Uber's bet everything on lowering prices and, it's gutting the industry at every level to grab market share. But at this point, I'm willing to pay a little more to use Lyft because I actually like to use Lyft.
Lyft is just just across the board a better experience.
Being able to tip your driver easily from the app. I mean, again, and it shows, right, the cultural value of just respecting your partners and the fact that Uber, I guess you technically can do it through that, but I still haven't figured out how, so.
And there's one more thing. Do we discuss the autonomy? Yeah, we discuss autonomy and what happens when drivers come out of cars in a pooled vehicle. Do we discuss that?
No, but you have an interesting theory on this. You should share it.
Well, here's my theory, and this goes back to, sexual assault dangers. So Uber was testing last month, and I think the test program went away, a flat rate subscription, I think it was $90 or $100 a month, in New York, in the five boroughs, for unlimited Uber pool between, I think, 8 a.m. and 8 p.m., and I could be off on the hours. And I had a couple of friends use it and a girlfriend of mine use it, and she loved it. She used it instead of the subway. But I asked her, I said, well, what happens if an Uber pool shows up and it was self-driving and there was like a creepy dude in the car? And she's like, well, I would never get in that car. So you can imagine, even if Uber executed on the autonomy plans and started trying to stick people in Uber pools, if one of them is a woman and she is the second passenger to get in, and there's some weird dude in that car who now knows where she lives, you've got a problem. Your trust problem now gets multiplied in a big way. So there is a universe of issues surrounding autonomy and pooled shared vehicles that has not yet happened. And you foresee a solution which can't work, which would be passengers rating each other. And then you have a Yelp problem because you're going to have women downrating dudes that make them feel uncomfortable, and dudes who want to get in cars with women who are upgrading the women they want to ride with. And it's a shit show. So that's not going to work, and Uber is not going to be saved by that. I'm done with that theory. So,
Ed, the other thing you brought up during this larger discussion is kind of where NHTSA is at, where DOT's going under the under 45's administration. So I know you've been following this way more closely than I have, although, you know, I'm reading the morning transportation from Politico and everything. But, you know, what's been your sense? I know you've been talking to some people both internally and externally. What's been your sense of both Chao and just the larger administration's take on where they're looking at kind of not just autonomy, but just kind of larger transportation technologies?
So I mean, Chao is sort of an interesting symbol for the broader situation, because I think, you know, clearly this is someone who is, you know, politically well connected, and one can easily imagine some sort of political deal is what landed her at the top of DOT. And you know, she is sort of, she came out and said that autonomous vehicle regulations are going to transition. There's going to be changes, which, right, not hugely surprising, but she was very vague about it. And everything that I'm hearing is that there's not a lot of leadership at the top of DOT right now. The Chao does not have a clear vision for what, you know, the agency's priorities should be, what to do, how to proceed. That's a little worrying. I think underneath that, you know, I think the entire government is going through this very difficult transition, you know, where sort of, you know, there are folks who've been very comfortable there for the last 8 years, and they're not so comfortable with the new leadership, and there's questions about leaking and, you know, for both sides and this sort of conflict. So I think there's uncertainty at the top, there's sort of conflict within. But I think broadly, as I said before, I think there is probably the strongest sense that I get at this point is that there is a feeling that, again, I think certain companies, and, you know, having written about Tesla, for example, and you know, sent things to NHTSA, you know, that I sort of expected a strong response on and then kind of have disappeared and been buried, this resonates for me, although, you know, this needs to be reported more, but it sounds like there's a sense that NHTSA in particular, but regulators in general, have been sort of giving a free pass to certain companies that are more, you know, politically aligned with the past administration. And I think there's a...
Why don't you just name them?
Because I would like to... I think there needs to be some real reporting done before we get too far ahead of ourselves with this. Right now I'm relaying, right, what I've been hearing. This is not stuff that has been conclusively proven to me. So I'm not going to say this is exactly what has happened. I'm saying there's this perception that some companies have been, and I think Silicon Valley in general has been sort of allowed to kind of do whatever they want. And I think, you know, again,
Tesla.
Again, like we were just talking about, right? I mean, you can see in the behavior of these companies broadly and individuals within them that there seems to be this culture of impunity. So to me, this all matches up. What I'm not clear about is, you know, what exactly is the positive vision? I think it's still emerging. I think, you know, beyond sort of correcting what they see as been a sort of a laxity in the past administration or sort of uneven-handedness. So I think it's a good thing that, you know, the major thrust here is to sort of start enforcing regulations more even-handedly. I think that, you know, the way to think about it is, you know, there's a desire to reduce regulations, right, that are unnecessary, but those regulations that are going to stick around have to be enforced fairly. I think that's a really good thing. And I think, frankly, you know, all this news coming out of Silicon Valley is sort of a cry for help that, you know, frankly, we need some grownups. You know, we need to have some rules, and we need to know that those rules are being enforced, you know, or else bad things
happen. All right, so that's all well and good. Here's the impression I'm getting from outside that bubble, which is this administration is kind of reeling. Let me rephrase that. DOT and NHTSA under this administration doesn't seem to really have a clear idea of what they want to do, what they want to accomplish, or even really have their heads wrapped around the challenges that are facing them.
Well, look, I mean, I think that is, to some extent, certainly it is the case. Like I said, there's clearly some turmoil within the agencies and sort of some disagreements, I think, maybe on a certain level about the broader direction to go. But I think, you know,
when you say there's disagreements, are you saying like a difference between like just kind of like a libertarian, hey, let them do this and they'll figure it out, let the market sort it?
Yeah, I think there's the factions within agency that kind of split different ways. I think there's clearly some folks who are there, who have been there, who are and who are new, who are a little more friendly with Silicon Valley and kind of embrace the sort of, you know, let's let them innovate and not get in their way. And then there's some other folks who are a little bit more you know, worried about this culture of impunity that's arisen and you know, really a little more driven to put down some rules. But we can't separate this from the broader context, right? Which is that, you know, name the regulator out there that does know how they're going to handle the autonomous vehicle situation, right? This is, so you know, I definitely think there's, you know, maybe there's not very many people coming into DOT right now that have a lot of, you know, specific vision about where to go forward, but people who do have that vision are just hard to find generally.
Well, just to be clear, you know, I having interviewed Sully last week and just gone through my transcript of his interview, it's pretty clear that on the NHTSA or is the DOT panel on autonomy, there's like two people from the truck industry, Sully, and then everyone else is pretty much, you know, gung-ho for autonomy. Do you guys see? I'm sure you've seen The Matrix. Did you ever see The Matrix animated spinoff?
The Animatrix?
There's a really important lesson in The Animatrix for the Trump administration and the Republican Party.
We're just going to start having Alex's like pop culture minute in the middle of these podcasts. It's been great.
Map of the future, and there's dystopian futures, and there's positive futures. And in The Animatrix, which is something like, you know what, it was like 30, 50 years from now, you have, you know, robots doing everything and full automation and humanity is decadent. But there are at one point, robots aren't doing everything, but there are riots and demonstrations around the world as humanity is, you know, the robots begin building goods cheaper than humans and people are unemployed. And there's like an anti-robot uprising. Let's pull that notion back to where we are today with DOT and the Republicans. So on one hand, you have the argument for a libertarian approach of reducing regulation, and which means that you know, a lot of people are going to lose their jobs. So the timelines for self-driving cars may not fall within, you know, the next 7.5 years or 8 years of a Trump administration. But let's suppose automation in a real way did arrive for trucking. Let's suppose it arrived halfway through Trump's theoretical second administration or Pence's, and then you have a core group of voters. All skewing right, who are truck drivers, and a mountain of truck drivers lose their jobs to self-driving trucks. So the Republicans would have been, in theory, gutting an important voting block, and as a result of libertarian policies favoring automation and self-driving tech. And that's something that even if this current administration, if they were aware of it, and I haven't heard the word automation come out of Trump's mouth, if he becomes aware of it, it's a real conundrum. It's a real problem. And if they say proceed with reducing regulations on autonomy, they're handing the next, if it was a Republican administration, a Pandora's box of one that I wouldn't want to have to face. So,
yeah.
Well, I mean, if there's anything this administration is good at so far, it's passing the buck. So.
Well, I would just say, you know, I think. You know, politics are very cultural at this point. And I think that, you know, if you're right of center, you know, a certain amount of libertarianism tends to, you know, seep into whatever you're talking about. That said, I don't get the sense that this administration is ideologically libertarian. I think there's...
Well, that's mainly because there is no ideology.
Well, no, yeah. And I mean, you know, I don't think that that's a terrible thing here, right? Because I think... You know, clearly there's some desire to, you know, not put, you know, roadblocks in the way of business and innovation, and that's good. However, I think there is an appreciation for the populist issues around job loss, as Alex points out. Although, I'm still not sure how solid that is. I'm just dealing with impressions here. But also, I think on the regulatory side, you know, again, what I hear is that there's a desire to consistently enforce the regulations that we have. Again, we can reduce them, but if we have them, everyone should play by the rules. And that is not something that, you know, your typical libertarian, even if they would agree with that position, is going to go out and espouse and sort of make central to their agenda. So I would not expect sort of, you know, orthodox libertarian approaches to these issues. I think there's, and you know, and I think if you look at the history of automotive regulation as well, it's pretty hard to argue that it doesn't do, you know, have an impact, right? I mean, since NHTSA has been created, with huge reductions in the amount of on-road deaths. So I think I would look for the administration to be, you know, err on the side of populism. I agree. You know, don't expect them, I don't think, to be incredibly ideologically rigid. I think they're going to sort of pursue different, you know, approaches with different subjects. But in general, you know, I think expecting that regulations are just going to be gutted, at least when it comes to autonomous vehicles, that's not an assumption I would encourage people to have.
Well, actually, an interesting point here is that because of Uber and Lyft and, you know, hailing services, the number of people actually driving taxis has gone up in this country, whereas we have yet to see the effects of of autonomy on the trucking industry. You know, talking to some of the people in the self-driving truck industry, they all cite the same number. You know, Varden Labs, which became Embark, and Starsky Robotics, both having come out of stealth mode in the last 2 weeks, they both cite a number of a 100,000 shortage, driver shortage in the trucking industry. And if you compare the theoretical business models of the people attacking trucking, they're radically different. Of course, Otto, Uber's division, all they've come out and said is that they're developing self-driving trucks. And the presumed business model is to sell self-driving trucks to trucking companies and, you know, eliminate drivers altogether. The end goal being 100% elimination of drivers, which is something that no administration would want to be responsible for. And then you've got Embark claiming that their technology will be a hybrid technology, that truckers can stay in the trucks, but that their technology will just make it safer. So it's an augmentation system. You have Peloton, which is doing platooning. So one driver in a truck with multiple trucks behind following. So that reduces the number of truckers overall. And then you have Starsky at the other end of the self-driving business model truck continuum, who want to remove the drivers from the trucks and put them into a kind of remote drone control facility. And so one guy can control many trucks, but only during the first and last mile. And so in this spectrum, you know, all these companies are going to fall under whatever regulatory environment evolves. And yet some of them are very much about annihilating a voter block, and the others are about protecting it to some degree. And so that's going to be very interesting to see whether they all fall under, you know, the carpet at one time under one regulatory standard, or if some of them are given a pass and some just suffer. And we all, I think, know where auto is going to follow.
You mean they're going to proactively engage with regulators at every step, yeah, to make sure they're in full compliance, right, exactly, with all?
Interestingly, Starsky claims that they have a very warm relationship with the DOT, and that they've been talking to them for quite a while. And that's, you know, I'd like to see evidence of that. But that's interesting. They're also already delivering shipments while simultaneously testing the autonomous tech on the trucks, which include a human engineer, which is kind of following maybe kind of the Tesla model. Whereas Otto, I think that their claimed delivery was a one-off from what I can tell, with their end goal being, you know, terror for truck drivers. I don't know. But I'm sympathetic towards guys like Starsky and I think Embark for at least trying to use autonomy in a way that protects jobs or at least keeps drivers in the trucks to the extent that it actually makes sense. So yeah. autonomy only for the highway portion and remote control for the other portion. And also Starsky's big kind of sales model, which I like, is that trucking is a shitty job and that truckers can now stay close to home and do their jobs while maintaining a personal life. So that's a rare example. I mean, why hasn't like Uber come out and said that they're going to make remote facilities for Uber drivers so they can stay home? Because, you know, in California, there's been stories about parking lots, you know, I think near where you live, Damon, packed full of Uber drivers who choose to sleep in the cars, you know, a day or two from home in order to hit, you know, areas where they can drive Uber Black and make more money.
Literally my last Lyft ride, guy's in a Chevy Traverse. Ask him where he's from. He's from Stockton. For those of you that don't know the Bay Area, like Stockton to San Francisco without traffic, it's a solid like hour and a half, hour and 45. And that's exactly what he does is he comes out for a couple days. If he can't crash with a friend, he parks down by the beach. He has a blanket and a pillow in the back. And that is his evening.
Well, and I think it's, you know, this overview, Alex, that you gave of sort of these different approaches to trucking is really interesting. A, because, you know, trucking, I think as consumers, right, we tend to think of new technologies as like, well, when do I get my self-driving car? But if you look at the economics of it, clearly trucking and delivery is where the economics of autonomous technology pencil out faster than they do for consumers, whereas unless you sell it as like a luxury thing for consumers. But I think what's interesting here is that if you look at these different approaches, and then you think about them in terms of what Uber and Lyft are going through right now, I think we have a very interesting test with this that, you know, is Lyft going to be able to leverage the fact that it has a better relationship with regulators, it has better relationship with drivers, and it has a better image with passengers? Is it going to be able to leverage those intangible cultural, social issues, which in general Silicon Valley firms, I think, have ignored to their peril? Are they going to be able to turn those advantages into something that will really drive their business and help them close the gap to Uber? If so, then I think you start thinking about these sort of different trucking models very differently in terms of trying to look at what's going to do better and what's going to do worse. If, on the other hand, Uber sort of shrugs this whole, you know, episode off and kind of continues to dominate the mobility as a service space, I think it'd be unfortunate because I think, you know, it's going to foster a culture in Silicon Valley that, again, tends to ignore the social, cultural, and yet political impacts of the technology that they're bringing to market, which in turn, I think, down the road has the potential to create intense social upheaval. You know, when Uber says, okay, we're not going to have drivers anymore. When trucking, you know, when these layoffs start to hit, you know, we saw, you know, back in the, well, we didn't see, but in the Industrial Revolution, you know, when these phenomenal changes happen abruptly and they're sort of forced onto people, that tends to create, right, you know, communism back then and these other sort of reactions. And it's interesting to think about the possibility that maybe if Lyft is able to leverage this stuff and sort of say, we've foreseen sort of these social cultural issues and we're trying to, you know, make this innovation, you know, actually a little bit less disruptive. You know, normally everyone's competing to be who could be more disruptive. Think about the social side, you know, if a Lyft can be less disruptive and can brand that as something that, you know, you get the same service that you would get with Uber, but you're doing it in a way that allows this technological transition to become more smooth and to be less harsh on the people who are most vulnerable in our society. I think that's a really interesting way forward for Silicon Valley. And I think all the leaders in Silicon Valley would do well to think about that because, again, you know, these social, cultural, political issues have all been subordinated to the technological issue, which, again, I think creates a potential for real, real upheaval down the road.
Totally agree. Couldn't
have said it better myself.
Yep, agreed. actually, wait, there's one more fun anecdote. It's a short one.
Shoot.
Last week, George Hotz tweeted that he launched into a Tesla dealership and put down a deposit on a car that he claimed he was going to pick up the next day, which I guess suggests that he was getting a car out of inventory. I imagine it was in the, you know, San Francisco area. And then he tweeted soon thereafter that his order was canceled. So, of course, lots of comments and questions circling his Twitter feed And I got some calls from people asking whether it was canceled because Elon Musk doesn't want him to have a car. which if that theory is to hold water, why would Musk not want him to have a car? I suppose because they don't want HOTS getting a look at hardware too and what Autopilot's doing today. I don't know. But I will say this. Based on my having used a Comma 1 and a Neo-driven device, which is the aftermarket Comma from our friends at Matt Scholwitz, it sounds to me like the Hardware 2 Autopilot Autosteer is not as good as George Hotz's canceled device. So hopefully we'll learn more about that in the coming weeks if I can get into a Tesla, and I'll be talking to Hotz about it. Any theories, guys?
Well, I have to say, I mean, the fact that you haven't driven Autopilot Hardware 2.0 along with the videos that have been circulating recently, but I think the fact that, you know, Alex Roy has not driven this yet is, to me,
That seems telling, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, Alex has uniquely carved out a space where he's, the most credible reviewer of these kinds of systems. Tesla has benefited enormously from giving him access in the past. Now no longer. To me, that's pretty damning.
Well, to be fair to Tesla, I have not been in California to get a car, and there aren't many press cars in New York. However, they have said that they will give me a car to drive in a couple of weeks when I get back to California. What's curious, what I really would like to see is someone get a Hardware 1 car with the latest updates side by side with a Hardware 2 car. That's something no one has done, and I'm amazed that some hardy individual out there hasn't, with some creativity, hasn't done that. That I'd like to see.
I got $20 on the GoFundMe. Let's do it.
We could maybe in a couple of weeks when I'm out there, we could go find on Turo a Hardware 1 car and do a side by side. That would tear up the internets.
Yep, I'm in on that GoFundMe. Let's do it.
All right. So,
and I suspect there might be a few people listening to this podcast that could help us out too.
Yeah, I suspect that as well. I have no evidence for this at all. But can you imagine if Hotz actually got his hands on a Hardware 2 car and stuck and somehow connected a Comma device to it, and how good it would be? Like, if it worked well at all, I mean, there'd be riots in the streets, dogs and cats sleeping together.
It certainly looks like Tesla could use the help at this point.
Ooh. All right, on that sick burn, we'll leave it there. Gentlemen, always a pleasure, and we will talk soon.
All right.
Sounds good.
Bye.